from WKAR's Studio S at Michigan State University, this is Current Sports.
Hey, 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 what's going on, good people? Hope you all had a fantastic Easter holiday. Beautiful weekend, too. Beautiful weekend. 70 degrees, the sun shining, birds chirping. It was a great time. I actually got to go down to Detroit, see the fam, and, you know, spend some great time with them. But we are back at it here on the show with a ton to talk about, including the Boston Marathon. We'll talk a little Tigers, Red Wings, NBA playoffs, a full plate, folks. And again, we are opening our phone lines throughout this entire hour. If you want to call in and give your thoughts on anything, 517-355-9527. We'll be taking your calls throughout this entire hour. You can also go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports and also tweet me at Al Martin, WKAR. I'm struggling a little bit today, guys, because it is allergy season, and my allergies always flare up around this time, so I may sound a little nasally throughout the hour, but hey, bear with me on that, okay? But again, that number is 517-355-9527. Interesting news. I'm seeing here on ESPN.com right now that the New York Knicks have decided to fire Mike Woodson. We all saw that coming. I mean, Mike Woodson definitely struggled, to say the least, during his tenure with the New York Knicks. A great coach, though. I don't want this outing with the Knicks to take away from all that Mike Woodson has done throughout his entire NBA coaching career. He's an outstanding coach, just in a bad situation. So much so that not only was Woodson fired, but also the entire coaching staff. Yeah, Phil Jackson is not playing, folks. Phil Jackson fired Mike Woodson and the entire coaching staff just a few hours ago, actually. So there you have that. The Knicks are certainly going to be rebuilding, and this is the right way to do it, though. I think this is a good move for the Knicks. I mean, the Knicks are a team, a historic franchise in the NBA, where I think is when the Knicks are good, and you know, teams like the Knicks and the Lakers, when they're good, the entire league is good. And you know, this is one of those moves to try to point the Knicks in the right direction. Going to be interesting to see who takes over Mike Woodson as the head coach of the New York Knicks. Of course, one of the leading candidates have been Steve Kerr right now. His name has been floated out a lot when it comes to this coaching search for the New York Knicks. But, hey, it's a move in the right direction, and, you know, I'm pretty pleased to see that move made. So Phil is certainly getting to work ASAP. So, all right, ladies and gents. Well, again, we're opening up our phone lines throughout this entire hour, 517-355-9527. We're going to dive into the Red Wings and Boston Bruins series. Of course, Boston tied it up last night. Talk about the Boston Marathon and so much more. Let's dive right into it. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners for this April 21st, 2014. Okay, the Detroit Tigers, folks. The Detroit Tigers, they went on to beat the Los Angeles Angels on Sunday, 2-1. They took the three-game series. Rick Porcello, he pitched seven sharp innings for the Tigers. He allowed a run, five hits, striking out four and walking one. Three relievers finished, with Joe Nathan pitching the ninth for his third save in five chances. Now, the Tigers, they begin a four-game series against the Chicago White Sox tonight at 7:08 p.m. Detroit right-handed pitcher Anibal Sanchez, he will face left-handed pitcher John Danks. So, again, that's 7:08 p.m. tonight, the Tigers and the White Sox. All right, and also Alex Gonzalez, if you didn't hear this news, the Alex Gonzalez experiment is officially over, folks. Less than a month after being acquired by the Tigers in an effort to address their shortstop vacancy, Gonzalez has been unconditionally released. The team announced that early Sunday. Now, the move opened up a spot for utility infielder Danny Wirth, who had his contract purchased from AAA Toledo. Now, Wirth, the final cut made by the Tigers this spring, hit 308 with five doubles and two stolen bases in 14 games with the Mudhens. I tell you, Danny Wirth, he's certainly, you know, when it comes to his minor league career and his major league career, he's definitely had to have a bag packed because he's been back and forth for quite some time now. Now, the Tigers acquired Gonzalez in late March in exchange for utility player Steve Lombardozzi, who was traded to Baltimore less than 4 months after arriving in Detroit as part of a trade that sent Doug Fister to the Washington Nationals. So, Alex Gonzalez is gone. We'll give you our thoughts on whether or not that is a good move. Of course, Gonzalez, he is no spring chicken at 37 years old. If you want to give your thoughts on it, 517-355-9527. And the Boston Bruins, they got a 4-1 win over the Detroit Red Wings in Game 2 of their playoff matchup. The series is now tied at one game apiece. Now, the Detroit Red Wings got just one shot on goal during their four power plays, just one shot on goal. That's crazy to me. Now, Game 3 of the best-of-seven series between the top-seeded Bruins, who won the President's Cup with an NHL-high 117 points, and eighth-seeded Red Wings is set for Tuesday night in Detroit. So there you have that. Series is tied 1-1. Kind of saw that coming, though. This is Boston we're talking about, folks. And a wild opening weekend when it comes to the NBA playoffs. It saw several lower seeds steal Game 1 and home court advantage. Now, Saturday saw three lower seeds win on the road, with the Nets topping the Raptors, the Warriors beating the Clippers, and the Hawks beating the Pacers. Now, only the Thunder, the 2 seed in the West, protected their home floor, topping the Memphis Grizzlies. Now, Sunday was more of the same, folks. 1 seeds, Miami and San Antonio, earning wins over Charlotte and Dallas, respectively, and both 5 seeds winning road playoff openers, with the Wizards topping the Bulls, Portland outlasting Houston, and in the first overtime game of the season in that one, too. It was an exciting game last night in that one. Now, the action continues tonight with a Grizzlies Thunder and Warriors Clippers doubleheader on TNT. Should definitely be an exciting one, to say the least. And then also, TNT is honoring Craig Sager, of course, longtime famed sideline reporter with Turner Sports, who was always known for his flashy suits. It was pretty cool because the entire TNT staff, they all wore crazy suits to honor Craig Sager, who was battling leukemia. Hopefully he beats that. So, but again, Grizzlies Thunder, Warriors Clippers tonight on TNT. The Michigan State softball team, they took 2 out of 3 games in Iowa City this weekend to claim their first series win of the Big Ten season and first ever series against Iowa City. So there you have that. They finally win in Iowa City, folks. Now, senior Kelly Smith, who has been outstanding, she continued her dominance after recording a no-hitter early last week. A no-hitter, folks. We talked about it here on the show last week. She scattered 5 hits and struck out 6 in a 4-0 shutout win in Sunday's rubber match. So how about that? And MSU, they took a 1-0 lead in the third inning, tacked on another in the fourth, and got their insurance runs in the 6th and 7th innings. So I'm sure Jackie Joseph's certainly happy about that outing. And the MSU baseball team, folks, quite the contrary when you compare it to the softball team. Things didn't go well for the MSU baseball team. They got swept by Indiana over the weekend, coupled with last week's loss to Central Michigan. And the Spartans are reeling after losing now 4 straight, folks. 4 straight losses for the MSU baseball team. Now, Friday, they saw the Hoosiers blow out MSU in front of their home crowd, shutting down the Spartans in a 7-0 win. And Saturday and Sunday, which saw closer games, a 2-1 loss, though, in 12 innings, and a 4-1 defeat, respectively. Now, MSU is back on the diamond tomorrow against Toledo at Cobbs Field. So we'll see if they can get back on track. And do you guys remember this movie? Remember Denzel Washington playing the role of Reuben Hurricane Carter? One of my favorite sports movies. Denzel definitely played he did an outstanding job in that movie. But it's based off the life of the actual fighter, Reuben Hurricane Carter, the middleweight boxing contender who spent 19 years in prison after being wrongly convicted of a triple murder. He has sadly died in Toronto. Now, Carter spent 19 years in prison for that triple killing in New Jersey before a federal judge ruled in 1985 that he did not receive a fair trial and released him. Now, Carter was 76 years old and passed away due to complications from prostate cancer. So thoughts and condolences out to the Carter family. And Michelle Wee, she's back on the scene, folks. Michelle Wee, she rallied from 4 strokes back to shoot a 5-under on Saturday and win the LPGA Lott Championship. Now, the win was Wee's 3rd career victory on the LPGA Tour and first since 2010. And looking back at one historic day, when you talk about not only in the world of sports, but just in our modern American culture, of course, that tragic situation that took place in Boston at the Boston Marathon last year. Well, the annual Boston Marathon, it took place today, 1 year ago, since those horrific bombings. And last night, several running groups who had trained for the race together were invited to the home game of the Boston Red Sox game against the Baltimore Orioles to run out on the field before the team's game. And there was also a short tribute for the Boston Marathon tragedy of last year. And looking just now, about an hour ago, we do know the winner when it comes to at least the men's side of things. Meb Clefiji, he became Boston Marathon winner with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 27 seconds, becoming the first American to win the race since 1983. And later on in the hour, you're going to hear a pretty interesting piece from our own Melissa Benmark here at WKAR, as she got a chance to sit down and interview longtime Lansing native Elizabeth Demers, who is right now in Chicago right now, editor in Chicago. She really got hooked on the whole running scene and participated in the Boston Marathon. A pretty cool interview. You'll get to hear that later on the hour. You do not want to miss that. Can never forget about that tragedy that happened a year ago. All right, well, those are your current sports quick hit headliners. If you want to call in, give your thoughts on any of those, you know that number, 517-355-9527. Again, 517-355-9527. You can also go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports and also tweet me at Al Martin, WKAR. Well, the fellas now join me, production assistants Alex Shark and Matt Lucky. How you guys doing? Have a good weekend?
Great weekend, Al. Great weekend. How
good.
About you?
Good, good, man. I actually bought a dog.
Yeah, I saw that.
I bought a dog. It's a Morkie.
And,
yes, and you
man.
Being a sports guy, I heard a rumor on the street that you might enter Chibale in the mm-hmm. annual dog competition in Michigan.
She definitely could compete. She's a beautiful dog, man. You know, I went into Petland Novi on Saturday, and I drove up. I'm like, all right, we're going to look at dogs, you know, and we go in, right, and I see her, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, she's gorgeous. So, you know, it's pretty cool. At Petland Novi, they had, like, these little kennels that you can play with the dog and see how she acts and her mannerisms. And I played with her, and she spoke to me and said, Al, please buy me. I'm yours. Those are her exact words, and I was sold, and boom, now I have a dog.
Wow.
Crazy.
So you're starting to teach her
She's
how to do the high jumps, all the discus throws for the dog
Not
competition,
yet.
The dog show?
No, I don't know if she will get there. She's only 4 months right now, so we still got a lot of training to do. First training, potty training. And I tell you what, Matt, right now I am going through it. Because you have a pup right now, I know.
I do.
How long did it take to potty train your dog?
Actually, you know, Calvin was a quick learner. it took us a few weeks. It helped, though, that I had a week off right when we got him.
Okay,
so that,
good.
You know, because you got to be on point with that stuff.
Right, right. You do.
You got to nip that in the bud immediately.
Yeah, right now she's sitting at home. She cried when I left the house. And it's going to take some time. It's going to definitely take, I don't know, about 2 weeks. I'm going to set the bar a little lower than that, but
right.
We'll see.
Just baby steps every day.
Every day.
Was Chibale watching the playoffs with you?
She was, man. I watched just about every game. She was there watching. Well, during the first game, I believe it was Brooklyn and Toronto, I think, was one of the first games. I was out at Petland. Like, I listened to the game, and then I got out and bought her and then listened to it on the way back home. But, yeah, we watched a lot of playoffs this weekend. And speaking of playoff guys, let's start with hockey first. The Red Wings, the Detroit Red Wings. I mean, this is kind of inevitable for me. Boston last night tying things up. The series is now 1-1 with that 4-1 win from Boston last night to even the series. Guys, you know, looking at this series so far, first off, it was pretty surprising to see how well the Wings came out the gates in Game 1 for me to get that win over Boston. I mean, they turned a lot of heads with that win, and you're sitting there looking like, okay, these are the Red Wings here. This is a historic franchise with a track record of success. They are not going to lay down here and just let Boston walk all over them. Now, granted, a lot of people have Boston winning the entire thing. But to see what happened in that game one, I'm sitting there like, wow, this is going to be a great, great series. But then in game two, you kind of knew that Boston was going to eventually rebound from that loss. And boy, oh boy, they did it. They did it in an impressive fashion yesterday. If you look at it, it was just poor production on the power play for me, guys. If you look at the Red Wings, they went 0-for-4 in the power play, as opposed to Boston, who is third in the league when it comes to power play goals. They went 2-for-4. 0-for-4, and I believe they only got one shot on goal throughout four of those power plays. I mean, guys, I mean, when I look at those stats, I mean, that just comes down to lack of energy and aggressiveness to only get one shot on goal in four opportunities where you got the upper hand when it comes to men out there on the ice. I don't know, call me crazy, but when I look at that really glares out at me when you talk about that game too.
Sure, the power play production wasn't there, but honestly, I disagree with you. I think that the Red Wings just got unlucky. There's just some bad plays. They ended up in two goals. The Howard pass to the boards, which was like, what are you thinking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did see that. Yeah,
and then the other goal. Overall, I just think that it should have been a 1-1 game instead of a 3-1 game going in the third period. Two goals were just poor mistakes. I'd say the Red Wings met up to par. I don't think they underperformed the second game. I think that in the first two games, they've met up to par. I don't think it was above average. They played amazingly.
Have they exceeded your expectations, you think, in those first two games?
I think in the playoffs, yes. But look, they won the first game. You were like, wow. The second game, the score doesn't really tell for what actually happened in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the two mistakes, if they can cut down mistakes, especially at home, which shouldn't be too hard, I'd say that they have a pretty good shot of winning.
I can see that,
Boston won on mistakes, not skill, I don't think. Physical play and mistakes is how I see the game.
Yeah, Boston got Detroit out of their comfort zone, and you could see it—the drastic change from game one to game two was the physicality and how Boston was kind of able to impose their will and get the Red Wings to try and play their game. I mean, that's the one thing you hear almost too much in the playoffs, that we want them to play our game. But it was evident in the first two games of the series. You know, game one was obviously controlled by the Wings, game two by the Bruins. I mean, the Red Wings, when's the last time they had four roughing minors in a game?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Never. I mean, it just doesn't happen. They got, you know, uncomfortable. They got swept up in it. And, I mean, there's a reason Boston was the President's Cup or the President's Trophy winners. They're the best team in the league.
Right.
You knew they were going to come back after dropping game one and give their best effort, and they did. But like Alex said, the Red Wings just didn't get the bounces. And to have it be, I mean, it was 2-1 near the end of the second period, and then they gave up that last goal to Lucic in the last few minutes of the second period, and that was the one that killed them, because for the second period they had dominated. I mean, they outshot them like 20-10.
Yeah, they were
in
those
control.
Too.
You know, you could have seen it going down to the final minutes, and then they give up that goal to Lucic, and it kind of gets away from them. But I think if they kind of limit the penalties, start playing their game again, stop getting swept up in the physical play, that they have every chance to win the series. I mean, taking home ice, winning game one was huge. You never expect to go out and steal two games on the road from the top team in the conference. You're happy with the split. I think Detroit should be happy what they did this weekend, getting the split. They're in control of the series. They have home ice. They're kind of in the driver's seat, but you never know when you're playing the Bruins.
Right.
Yeah,
one last thing to add. The second goal, I don't know what you guys thought about it when it was a shot from the blue line. It went in between Howard's pads. It skirted out behind him in the crease.
Yeah, then somebody.
And then a guy comes in into the crease.
And hits it in.
Yeah. I don't know what you thought about that. I think that was another mistake that maybe they should have had back.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it was one of those bang-bang plays that gets past Howard. Nobody really sees the puck in back of him, including himself. And then all of a sudden you have a goal from, you know, just a heads-up play from another Boston player. So, and, you know, that really surprised me too, because if you look at the stats from this game, the Red Wings did outshoot Boston throughout most of the game. I mean, total shots on goal, 35-29. I mean, you talk about that aggressiveness as far as hits go, 33-29 in favor of Boston in that way. Giveaways, 11 giveaways from Boston compared to just 4 from Detroit. So, I mean, if you look at the stat line here, the stats don't, like you said, Alex, the stats don't tell the entire story of this game. So, you split two out in Boston. Now you come home to Detroit and see what you can do. Detroit has to come out more aggressive, but overall, the overall of where they're sitting right now in the playoffs, I think you got to be pleased with it.
CL, I thought they actually were aggressive enough, because how often do you see Brennan Smith challenging Chara, a guy who's 6 inches taller, 7 inches? I don't know. How much taller is Smith? I don't know. 10 inches taller, maybe. I mean, considerable height differences. Smith is challenging Chara to drop his stick, in the middle of a game and fight him. It was I've never seen anybody do something like that.
See, I think they need to tone that down, though.
You do.
Because they get caught up trying to beat up the Bruins, mm-hmm. they are not going to win. That is a losing battle.
But what
I think
it, what
you can match the physicality without trying to take it into the extracurricular stuff. You know, like you can lay out some hits. I mean, Cronwall was laying guys out, and then he got laid out later. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, that kind of stuff is fine. But when it comes to let's drop the gloves, let's start fighting, I don't know if that's a direction the Red Wings want to go.
So you
got to
pick and choose your battles.
Bruins. Absolutely.
Because, you know, a lot of the headlines I've been reading about this series is that, you know, can the Red Wings match, you know, the grittiness of the Bruins? I mean, this kind of, because the Bruins have this personality throughout the league to kind of bully you in a way. You know what I mean? And the question was, can these young Red Wings match that aggressiveness? And, you know, maybe a fight or two does show that, but at the same time, you got to be smart about it too, because you don't want that to take away from what you're trying to do on the ice. So it's going to be fun to watch, guys. I believe the series returns to Detroit tomorrow night. Should be a good one. Wings and Bruins, folks. And all right, NBA playoffs really quick, guys. Just surprises from what we saw over the weekend. NBA action is, I tell you, playoff action is nothing like it, especially that last night's game with the Trailblazers and Rockets. I don't know if you guys saw that game, but LaMarcus Aldridge throwing up 46 points. Unbelievable. I believe Damian Lillard, he had 30-something, too, to match him there. It was a great game. Harden had a good game as well. Fun to watch, but as far as surprises for me, guys, there were a lot of teams to come out and win that game, went on the road, that I did not expect to do so. First one, I can kind of see, though. The Hawks beating the Pacers. The Pacers just, and you know, Charles Barkley went on TNT. I don't know if you guys saw it, but he called them wussies. He wants to use another word, but he called them wussies on the air. And I'm sitting there, I agree with everything, every single verb, every single adjective that Charles used to describe the Pacers. Guys, I don't know, personally for me, it is so upsetting to see the talent and potential that's on this team that we saw at the beginning of the year. At the beginning of the year, you could look at the Pacers and I said, okay, this is a team that legitimately can knock off the NBA champs in the East. Now, looking at the way they played in the second half of the season, carrying on to this game one into the playoffs. Now, granted, it's game one. Things could change, and the Pacers could definitely move on.
Right, right.
But looking at just that game one of the playoffs, they look disengaged. Guys don't know where they want to be on the floor. It just looks at like they look like the Pistons out there in a way.
They look like it's the terrible team that were going through a slump about a month ago. It was the exact same problem. They were disengaged. They were making sloppy turnovers. We discussed this, Al, on the show, that it's such a catch-22, as you like to say, mm-hmm. all the time with the Pacers, and that it's honestly truly amazing that they're still a one seed, I think, to this point, over the Heat.
It was amazing that they were able to hold down that one seed, but the East was so bad
what I'm wondering, Al, is you see Paul George with his flashes, you see Roy Hibbert with his flashes. I don't think anyone's taken control solely of the Pacers and said, I'm gonna make the plays when it comes to the fourth quarter. I'm gonna be taking control of the ball and getting that last shot. It changes between so many different players with a role on the team.
I'm going to take the opposite. I think it's too many guys saying that right now. I think there's too many personalities like that on this team. I mean, because you saw, if you look at that Hawks game, you saw, you know, George trying to make something happen, Lance Stephenson with some four shots left and right.
Oh,
I mean, I'm sitting there like, there's no cohesiveness. That team aspect that they had with the team that you saw at the beginning of the year, every guy was getting equal touches. Of course, you had your superstar, Paul George, who I praise for knowing when to pick and choose, when to take over a game. That's totally out the window now. Guys are just jacking shots up. There's too many guys trying to be the man right now instead of looking at the common good on how we can win as a team. That's out the window now, and I think the Pacers are totally lost right now. I would hate to be Frank Vogel right now in his position right now, because as a coach, I wouldn't know what to do. I have no idea how to fix this team.
Yeah, I wouldn't know what to do either, and I think, honestly, they look terrible. They talk about teams, championship teams. They always talk about how they handled adversity through the year, and you don't know who you are until you get hit in the mouth and you got to take your lumps and pick yourself back up. This team doesn't seem to know how to do that at all. No. I mean, they've been in a tailspin ever since the All-Star break. Doesn't look like it's getting any better now. I can still definitely see them winning this series in, you know, seven games or something, but the Hawks should not. They have no business going to a seventh game against the Pacers. They have no business
right.
winning more than one game.
I mean,
if this goes longer than five games, the Pacers need to be majorly worried, hit the panic button. They're not going to go anywhere when they have to play real teams like the Heat or even, I mean, even going to round two, the Wizards or the Bulls.
Exactly.
Either of those teams could very easily beat the Pacers in round two.
I agree. It's so disappointing to see what this team is producing right now. And other surprises for me, I think this Clippers and Warriors series, guys, is going to be so good. I mean, looking at that game one and seeing how the Warriors pulled that game out, I mean, it was very, very impressive down the stretch. The Wizards and Bulls series, I think, is going to be a good one, too. I mean, looking at guys like, you know, Nene last night was great. Gortat, Beasley, John Wall. I mean, that team is very, very talented. Even though the Bulls, they did a great job of salvaging their season without their superstar. Guys like Noah stepping up, Taj Gibson stepping up. DJ Augustine is going to, I think, he has to be more aggressive, I think, down the stretch of games. I saw him being a little tentative at times last night. But that's going to be a really good series to look at, too.
And that's why I believe whoever wins that Washington-Chicago series will beat Indiana if they even make it past the Hawks. Mm-hmm. Because you said it, Wall, you've got all these different guards between the Chicago Bulls and the Washington Wizards versus the Pacers, who are struggling to find any identity at all with their guard with Stevenson and their point guards. That's where I think the big advantage is for them.
And then even Ariza last night. Did you guys see Ariza last night? He had a good game, too. I mean, the Wizards look good last night. Again, it's still early. It's only game one. But those were my surprises of just the weekend so far, guys.
Yeah, I got a lump in the Warriors winning game one against the Clippers.
Yeah.
Just because of how they did it. Because I think if before the series started, if you said, yeah, the Warriors are going to take one of two at L.A., you would have said, oh, well, Stephen Curry was going to have a game where he just went bananas and hit nine threes and scored 38 points.
Right.
He went 6 of 16 and had 14 and 7 with 7 turnovers. So it's not like he played his best game and they still won. I think if you're the Clippers, you got to be worried, because if this team is winning games on your home floor with their best player having a subpar effort, you might be in trouble. And I know Blake Griffin only played 19 minutes. He was in foul trouble the whole game. Andre Iguodala played 20. He was in foul trouble the whole game.
Right.
So it was kind of like tit for tat there. So I think going forward, if you're the Clippers, you got to be – you need a win in game two. I'll say that.
You do.
You absolutely need to win game two.
I think that's certainly a must, especially on your home court. You know what I mean? You got to protect home court, especially in the playoffs. And we all know the Golden State Warriors, you got watching that game on TV, watching any Warriors game on TV, that home crowd brings it, man. It looks like one of the best atmospheres in the NBA. So – it's fun to watch. The Clippers have to win, though, in game two, which will take place tonight. It's going to be fun to watch, 10:30 p.m. on TNT. All right, fellas. Well, let's hit the break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little Tigers baseball and an interesting interview with Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit News, Lynn Henning. You don't want to miss any of that. Again, you can call in and give your thoughts on anything we talk about, 517-355-9527. Current Sports returns in just a sec. Welcome back to Current Sports. I am your host, Al Martin. Well, let's talk a little Tigers, Detroit Tigers. They went on to beat the Los Angeles Angels on Sunday 2-1. They took the three-game series, 2-1. Rick Porcello, he pitched seven sharp innings for him. He allowed a run, 5 hits, striking out 4, walking 1. And also 3 relievers finished for him, with Joe Nathan pitching the 9th for his 3rd save in 5 chances. Now, the Tigers, they begin a 4-game series against the Chicago White Sox tonight, 7:08 p.m. Annabelle Sanchez takes the mound to face John Danks. So, don't want to miss that. So, the Tigers are certainly in action right now and not looking bad. And if you haven't heard, they have released Alex Gonzalez. The Alex Gonzalez experiment is officially over in less than a month after being acquired by the Tigers in an effort to address their, you know, that shortstop vacancy with, of course, Jose Iglesias being out with an injury. Now, the move opens up a spot for utility infielder Danny Werth, who has his contract purchased from AAA Toledo. Werth, pretty good minor league season so far, hitting .308, 5 doubles, 2 stolen bases in 14 games with the Mud Hens. Now, pretty interesting. Here on Current Sports, we have had our unbelievable team of students who work on the show day in and day out here on Current Sports Radio. We've actually put them on the air to create their own podcast. Now, the podcast could be centered around anything that suits their interest. And we had two great students by the name of Alex and Max who help out on the show all the time. And they actually got a chance to sit down with Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit News, Lynn Henning. They talked with Lynn last week about the status of the Detroit Tigers.
Oh, I think everybody's very, very pleased that Dombrowski really was pretty courageous on this move, because anytime that you do take what you might call a chance with a manager who is inexperienced or a head coach, he's inexperienced, you're trusting that they're going to be able to compensate for that lack of experience. And I thought that was definitely a long shot possibility when I knew that Osmus was a candidate, simply because when Dombrowski had gone with inexperience before with Alan Trammell, and not that it was Trammell's fault, but you could see that a seasoned manager really probably would have avoided a lot of the mistakes that are necessarily going to be made by a rookie. The difference with Osmus is he doesn't seem to make any mistakes. He's just a brilliant guy, and that's the reason that the front office decided to go with him, because not only is the intellect there at a high, high, high caliber, but also is his communication skills, his poise, his ability right. to handle all the facets of the job. And for that reason, I can see that they're very gratified with the appointment, and they should be, because he hasn't made any missteps yet.
You know, and he does have a great, you know, round of experience to work with this team. You know, he's got Miggy, he's got V-Mart, all these players who really stand out. But he also has a bunch of new players to work with, too. You know, the Tigers have kind of rebuilt themselves to be a team more oriented on defense and speed than they were before. What are your opinions on these new-look Tigers?
They're a different team, Melissa. They definitely are constructed differently, and, of course, that fits in with his philosophy. He wanted to get more active on the bases, and even with the existing roster, he would have been a little more active. But also the defense and the alignments that you can arrange. I think the fact that he appointed the defensive coordinator, which we haven't heard anything really ever heard of that title being used outside of a football field, it tells you a little a bit about how 21st century is. He's got thoughts from 18 years of being a big league manager, where he saw the game and all its intricacies, and he's implementing them. And he expressed those and verbalized those in such a way that Dombrowski and his staff knew that this guy was going to come in and really have ideas, thoughts, and a program in place that would equip him to be a big league manager, even though he hadn't worked even in the minor leagues before in that capacity. So I think that's what you're seeing here. Is definitely, it's a new era. I don't know how much difference it'll make in the win-loss column, because I'm a firm believer that your roster does that more than your manager. But to the extent to which he can make a difference, I think he's going to do that.
Now, Lynn, talk about how some of the problems the Tigers are having so far. Yes, they have 6 wins to just 4 losses. And Alex and I, before you came on, were talking about how shortstop is a very legitimate concern, because Alex Gonzalez is not going to get it done there long term. And Phil Koch still has not shown to be trusted by Brad Osmus. As Ian Kroll really is the first lefty out of that bullpen. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's really going to be a dice roll, and it was coming out of spring camp. That's why I picked them to finish third. Even when the Indians had plenty of problems and the Royals did, et cetera, I still thought the Tigers had about them the look of one of these years, beginning with the bullpen. And Koch is really not their only problem there, as we know, and replacing him is not going to end the concerns. I think more fundamentally right now, from a position standpoint, you're looking at two things. Then we'll get into the bullpen, even though the bullpen may be the great priority here. Shortstop is in flux, no question about it. And it was the day that Jose Iglesias went down with these stress fractures. Gonzalez and Romine looked like a pair that you could probably trust on a platoon basis defensively, but it's really not apparent that that's going to be the answer. Gonzalez at 37 is clearly not the player he was even 5 years ago. And so you pay a little bit of a price there immediately, and that's a significant price when you're talking about the most important position on the field and certainly in the infield. Romine can't hit, and, hey, sometimes you have to make a trade-off, but I'm not sure his defense is going to compensate for the fact that you do need a little bit of a net gain there on the two-way evaluation if you're going to play regularly in the big leagues, even as a platoon player. Not sure he's going to be up to that. And since the marketplace is so tight, it really leaves them probably to fill from within the organization. And they do have a couple of people there that I think are going to at some point be plugged in. Hernan Perez, if he hits, will be okay. There's no question about it. Now, is that going to happen? I'm not sure he's going to have to hit all that robustly to be a value add. And he's got the capacity. He had three doubles Sunday. I mean, this kid is not ineffective. He's just young, and he still swings at some pitches he shouldn't. But if he gets that under control, he could be a pretty good player. Eugenio Suarez down at Double A Erie is really the better player, probably. He's got great pop, very good in the field. But again, he's going to have to get some plate discipline. And at 22, that's easier said than done. You usually have to play your way through that. But I think one of those two guys will offer them an option. And then that brings us to the other position concern right now, which is catcher. And I don't know what's with Alex Avila. I'm flummoxed, stymied, completely at a loss to explain that. I do know this. If you get rid of him, that's probably about the time that he'll hit the way he can. This guy's bat speed, power, knowledge of the strike zone really is closer to what we saw out of his All-Star season in 2011, or even the second half of last year. He should be hitting, but he's not. But you add all those three elements together, the bullpen, shortstop, catcher, and those are three weak links, and weak links, of course, can break a game. So that's the reason everybody's a little concerned right now.
Now, to sort of change things up and end things a little bit here, the Tigers had probably the strongest rotation in the major leagues last year. You had Verlander, and you had Scherzer winning the Cy Young, Sanchez leading the league in ERA. Do you think the starting rotation will be as strong as last year, and Rick Porcello will be improved as promised? What are your thoughts on the Tigers' rotation coming out into 2014?
Collectively, I think, Alyssa, that they'll be fine. I don't think you're going to really see any downslide from last year. Smiley could actually end up being a little bit of a plus over Fister. I think everybody got a little carried away with Fister. By the end of the season, he was really their fifth starter. Porcello is a little irksome and a little infuriating to the fan base because he does get hit, and particularly he'll get hit by left-handers. But at the end of the year, what you see is he's given you about 200 innings with an ERA that you can live with. And he's 25, which means, again, he is more likely than not to get better. So I believe their rotation is just fine. What you can't do is have a very well-pitched game through six or seven innings and then see it undone by the bullpen or by something crazy at shortstop or by a catcher who's left five men on base. Those things in the game of baseball can really cost you cumulatively. And, again, they can certainly encounter all the good work that you're doing and just sort of subvert that. And I think that's what you've seen here through some of these early games. That's also a measure of baseball's intricacy and its mercilessness. It just doesn't really allow you any weak links or they turn into losses. But still a pretty good team. And as I said today, for all of the hand-wringing around here, they're still playing 600 ball. They're still in first place. And only one team in the American League has a better record. So sometimes you have to stand back and look at this stuff with perspective, too.
All right. Again, that is Lynn Henning. He is a Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit News. And very well done interview by Max and Alex. They do an outstanding job. Two MSU students here who work day in and day out here on the Current Sports Radio Show. So really briefly, guys, let's talk a little Tigers here. Of course, they are releasing Alex Gonzalez. That was released yesterday. That Gonzalez will be leaving the team, and Danny Werth will be moving up from AAA Toledo. So, you know, looking at this season so far for the Tigers, it's pretty interesting because I tell you what, I really like Brad Ausmus so far. The way he comes off and carries himself in post-game interviews, he's got a little humor to him here and there, which, you know, I think keeps the players loose in the bullpen a little bit. And, you know, I just like his personality right now. I mean, he seems very assertive when he's out there. when you talk about this team right now, we were just talking before the break. I believe you have Miguel Cabrera on your fantasy baseball team right now, Alex, and he's not – a lot of people are panicking right now because they haven't seen Miguel Cabrera play this bad ever in Detroit Tigers history or start off this bad, I think. And some people are really getting a little, you know, a little nervous about this whole stretch with Miggy, but it's still Miguel Cabrera. It's still early in the season. I think Miguel will come along as the season progresses. I don't think it's time to hit the panic button right now. I also really like Miggy at first because I think when you look at Prince Fielder, when he was here, I think now that you got the chance to put Miggy back at first, he's a considerable upgrade from Prince Fielder as a defenseman at first base. This Tigers team is in a good position right now, and it's still early. It always baffles me how in a baseball season, you know, you hear analysts sometimes, and you hear a lot of fans sometimes get so worried in April. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, look, they have hundreds of games left to play here. Just relax. This team will be fine. I'm not worried right now at all when it comes to any aspect of this team so far. Alex, you had a pretty interesting comment on the whole Alex Gonzalez releasing. Did you agree with it?
Right. I mean, I see. His production was low. Granted, it was not what they probably traded for. However, moving Alex Gonzalez and Jose Iglesias out, your only option left is Andrew Romine. Now, what a lot of people are forgetting is, although the Tigers have put a lot of money in, they've made a lot of trades, a lot of fans think that the farm system is depleted, that there's nobody there. It's kind of, we're here to win, and then we're going to suffer for the next 8 to 10 years. I feel like that's a common conception from many fans of the Tigers. However, Danny Wirth is a guy who was on the Tigers for a while in the last 2-3 seasons, has produced average numbers, nothing great, but maybe the Tigers organization sees something from him right now in AAA in that he can perform at the next level. The same reason why they've waited on Nick Castellanos to call up for 2 years, the same reason why they called up Ryan Rayburn for 2 seasons, they must see something in Danny Wirth because that is the only option they really have left when it comes to shortstops. Unless they move over someone to shortstop and they make some kind of other trade, if you're just looking with the pieces they have right now without making any other acquisition, Danny Wirth is the only option. So I think that the Tigers are hoping, or they see something in Danny Wirth that he's going to produce right now at the MLB level, and for whatever reason, that they're either going to make a trade or they're putting all their trust in Wirth, guys.
I tell you what, really quickly, Matt, before we get to you really quick, I do want to say, though, it did come up as a surprise for me because I thought if you look at Gonzalez, he is old. I mean, he's 37 years old. I think right now he'll probably be forced out to retire now, to be honest with you. I mean, he had that – if you look at the opening – he was opening day starter at shortstop, and he had that – you remember the bottom of the ninth winning hit? I'm sitting there like, okay, he could possibly be something that, you know, could be a shining light for this Tigers team. I don't think he played terrible at the position during his brief stint with the Tigers. It surprised me that the move was made because I thought they would at least give him more time to maybe get acclimated with that position. But, you know, now that he is gone – eventually, that is going to be a move the Tigers would have had to make because he is old. He's up there. Danny Wirth has had, you know, during his first 14 games with the Mud Hens, he's produced very, very well. But we've seen this from Wirth before. He's been with the Tigers, like you said. He's floated back and forth. He's always had to have a bag packed because the Tigers bring him up and send him down so often. But it did come as a surprise how early it happened. Yeah. Matt?
For me, I feel like I'm just getting flashbacks to Jose Valverde
last season. I do,
like,
too.
Is anyone else just really panicking that the Tigers will make the World Series or, you know, get deep into the playoffs and lose on a terrible play, you know, an error from the shortstop? Mm-hmm. It seems like the same thing. You know, the Tigers come into the season, they have really one kind of glaring hole. Last year it was closer, this year it's more shortstop. They do something to address it that kind of makes people scratch their heads. Last year it was signing Jose Valverde. This year it's trading for Alex Gonzalez, who Lombardozzi, who they traded away for him, is hitting .276 with a .288
on base. He's not playing bad.
It's not great, but it's certainly better than what Gonzalez was giving you. So they make a kind of a head-scratching move, and then they bail on it, you know, less than a month into the season. And that's still a hole on the roster. It's still there. It's a glaring weakness. They might be able to make up for it with, you know, the offensive firepower that they have and the big arms that they have in Scherzer and Verlander. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, sooner or later, it's going to rear its ugly head, and it's going to cost them a big game. So I think they have to address it somehow. I think putting all your faith and worth is a risky game to play, because
it is.
If it doesn't work out, maybe he's not the same player for his career. I mean, right. You got to think long-term with guys like that. So, you know, giving them too much too soon can be a huge detriment to your club going forward. So I think they need to find some outside solution. They need to make a move, do something to shore that up.
A lot of people who are studying this Tigers team right now are saying that the outside move might be a guy by the name of Steven Drew, a guy who's currently available to teams. I think there's some kind of, I didn't look too much into this, but there's some kind of deadline in June where if you acquire him after a certain date, you don't have to pay him as much money. I don't know if any of you two know anything about that, but it's something with some draft clause, I don't know. But Steven Drew might be the option that they're looking for. So if it's not Danny Worth and we're not putting all our eggs in one basket like what Matt said, Steven Drew might be the only option available outside of a trade. So
bottom line for me, don't panic. It's still early.
Right.
The Tigers have plenty of time to
figure this
out. And
they're in the lead of their division.
15
right.
games.
And they're exactly. So, all right. Well, let's hit the break. When we come back, we have an interesting interview done by our own Melissa Benmark, highlighting a Lansing native who actually participated in the Boston Marathon. Don't miss that. Current Sports returns in just a sec. Well, the Boston Marathon got underway this morning and actually saw its first American winner in quite some time. Rita Jetpo of Kenya successfully defended the Boston Marathon title as she could not enjoy a year ago, of course, after the fatal bombings. And, of course, like I said, when it comes to the men, pretty interesting stuff here, because when you talk about the Boston Marathon, we haven't seen an American winner when it comes to the men in quite some time. And Meb Clefizia, he became the Boston Marathon men's winner, a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 27 seconds, becoming the first American since 1983. Impressive stuff. Now, this long-lasting and long-standing tradition in the running world is even more significant to its participants this year in light of last year's bombings of the event. Sad, sad story there. A number of people from Mid-Michigan are participating, and last week, not literally, Melissa Benmark, she caught up with one of them last week. She doesn't run at all, but she spoke to Lansing native Elizabeth Demers, who these days is an acquisitions editor in Chicago. Demers didn't get hooked on running until she was well into adulthood.
I started distance running at 35, roughly. I'd moved to Lincoln, Nebraska from Michigan, and I'd kind of dabbled in running a little bit in Michigan, but I'd never run a race. And when I moved to Nebraska, my new coworkers just signed me up for a race even before they met me. And so I walked the first one, and then I thought, well, I could do better than that. And so did another 5K, and I ran it. And then I was like, oh, I think I could do better than that. So I did a 10K, and I ran that. And then I finally got to the point where I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a half marathon. So I ran that. And then, you know, what's the next step?
That's amazing. I didn't realize they signed you up without actually checking with you first. That's...
They needed an extra person on their company team, and they were like, oh yeah, sure, she'll do it. You know, they didn't know, and I was so new that I didn't dare say no, I won't do it.
So what kind of training then is involved to get yourself from there to the place where you could consider being in the Boston Marathon? I mean, what kind of daily or weekly routine do you have?
Well, it depends on every race that I run. So your training for a half marathon is going to be a little different from your training for a full marathon. And I think I ran maybe 3 halves before I actually finally ran my first race, which was the 2007 Chicago Marathon. And I found a training program from Runner's World, and it was 3 days a week, which fit into my life pretty well. And I had a pretty good race. And I thought, oh, okay, well, so I did another marathon, and I did the same training plan. And then when I did my Boston qualifying race, which was the 2012 Detroit Marathon, I used the Hanson's training plan, and they have a running store in suburban Detroit, and a really pretty radical training plan, and it was great. And so in that plan, you go out and run every day, and you run faster, but you don't necessarily run longer distances. In the first training program I used, you kind of built up to having, you know, you had your one regular run. You have what you call a tempo run, which is when you kind of run faster, and then you have speed work, And then you have a long run every week, so you kind of build up to your 20-miler. And the standard philosophy for running a marathon is that you have to build up to your 20-miler. And the Hansen's plan isn't like that at all. You run 3 16-mile runs before you go out and do your marathon.
And you're in Chicago now, so how in the world do you, especially with a winter, like if yours has been anything like ours, how do you train outside during?
Oh, it's been terrible. It's been absolutely terrible. I belong to a gym that has a track, quarter-mile track, so that's been really helpful. And the treadmill, but sometimes you just have to, like, gut it out. You know, you have to have the right gear. You have to have warm socks, and you have to have gloves, and you have to have an ear snuggie, and you have to, you know, have a windbreaker. So if you have gear, you can get out there and do it. But it's more psychological than it is anything else, and it is a lot easier to not run than it is to go run, especially if the weather is biting you.
You mentioned when we were talking before this that qualifying for this Boston Marathon was on the complicated side, in part because of the bombing last year. What can you explain a little bit about that for our non-running lay people out there?
Sure. To get into the Boston Marathon, you have to run a time that is specific to your age and sex. So I'm 47. I had to run a 3:55 qualifying time. And at Detroit in 2012, I ran a 3:53:21. So that should be enough. But the cutoff really kind of changes every year based on how many people are trying to get into Boston and how fast they've run. So after the bombing, there was a huge groundswell of support for Boston, and people wanted to run it, and they wanted to support the victims, and they wanted to support the city of Boston. And I wasn't sure that I would even get in, even with what I thought was a pretty good cushion on my qualifier. And I ended up getting in by 1 second. So I'm really happy.
Wow. So you were already thinking about and working toward Boston 2014 before the bombing last year. Do you remember where you were and what your reaction was last year when you found out about the bombing?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was sitting in a class. I was taking an all-day seminar that day, and I didn't have access to the internet, or, you know, I wasn't watching television or anything. And so I started getting all these text messages on my phone from people who knew that I had qualified previously, asking me if I was in Boston and I was okay. And I kept thinking, what's going on? What's going on? And I found out that somebody had bombed the Boston Marathon. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I couldn't get my head around it. Who would bomb a marathon? A marathon is the most inclusive, kind of happiest place you can be. And it just really threw me. And at that point, I mean, I knew that there would be that huge groundswell of support. And so I just kept my fingers crossed that my time was going to be good enough. And I'm just really honored to be able to run it this year with everybody else and to be part of that crowd that standing up against that kind of oppression. So,
do you think that because there was the bombing last year, that will sort of be in the back of your mind as a nervousness factor? Or do you think that once you get there, there'll be enough for you to think about, you know, just doing the race? I mean, do you have a sense of kind of where that will be, where that
you
will
know,
put
I haven't
you?
Really even thought about the bombing and safety as a nervous creating issue, because the security is just so tight this year. They've changed a lot of rules, and I mean, I think they've got that really well covered. And the Boston Marathon is such a huge thing in and of itself, even without that. So I do have nerves, but they're more about just, you know, having gotten to the pinnacle of racing. And I'm not going to win it. You know, I'm not going to be fast. I'm probably not going to requalify when I'm there, but I'm just so excited to be there and so kind of just nervous about, you know, being in the right place and getting where I need to go. And so there's all these logistics that you have to deal with. And I'm really excited about the race itself, the crowds and the towns that you go through. And it's just supposed to be so wonderful. And I think it's going to be just extra amazing this year because of everything that's been going on.
I seem to remember you were in the one Chicago marathon where it was really hot and people were just dropping and one runner died and people ended up in the hospital. I seem to remember some story with them telling you to stop and you wouldn't stop.
My first marathon ever, and I had, you know, I was really super nervous, and it was a huge deal for my life, and I talked to everybody I knew that I'm doing this marathon. It's going to be great, right? And you know, I can't go out. I can't do anything because I'm running this marathon. And I get there, and it's a hot day, and I hadn't run enough to know that I was supposed to be worried about it, because it'd been hot all summer, and I'd been training all summer. And so as you're running along, and it's a very slow race, and I didn't know any better, and people are sweating, and the aid stations are full, and there's sirens everywhere. And I was about mile 20 when we got this announcement that the race had been canceled. And if you were after mile 13, you could finish the race. But they were yelling at people to stop running. I mean, the police were standing in the streets and yelling, stop running. And I'm thinking, you know, this was my first race. I'm never doing this again. I'm never running another marathon. I'm not going to stop running. This is it for me. I'm going to go for it. I mean, it's also like 90 degrees, so you're not moving that fast, right? But it's still a lot. But it was chaos at that point, and they had it was surreal because they had helicopters buzzing the race and, you know, blaring out, stop running, the race is over. So we finished the race, and it was also really confusing on the course because they were taking aid stations down, but there were still runners on the course, and it was just kind of one of those crazy things. And I crossed the finish line, and I got my medal, and, you know, it counted as a race, and I thought, wow, I totally have to go do this again.
So just having that experience was not about to deter you, that sounds
I didn't know enough that I should have been deterred, actually. I think if I had been more experienced and just had, you know, a better sense of how it was supposed to go, I might have dropped out or done something different, but I just didn't really know enough, and I felt pretty good throughout the whole race. It was a slow time. I think I did a 5:15. It was my slowest race ever, but, you know, when it's that hot out, you just can't expect to be fast.
Can you talk about some of the ways that you prepare mentally and physically for something like this?
Absolutely. I think running is 90% mental. And it's all about believing that you can do it and getting out there and, you know, having the courage to drag yourself out of the house every day and having the courage to drag yourself mentally through a race. When I did my qualifier in Detroit, it was hard. It was the fastest I'd ever run. And the last part of the race was just flat-on mental toughness. I mean, I know that's kind of a cliche. And I think that's true for any marathon. There's a saying that you run the first part of a marathon on your legs, and you run the second part on your training, and you run the third part on your heart or something like that. And that's really true. For that race, I had a lot of confidence because I had trained really hard for it. And something kind of hit me a week or two before the race that I knew I could qualify because I knew I had done the training and I believed in it and I believed in myself. It wasn't just hope at that point. I run other races where I know that I can't break any records or I can't do anything, and that's fine, and you just go out and run for the enjoyment of it. But the hardest part about running, I think, is getting out and doing it mentally. Once you start, physically running isn't that hard. It feels great. You get through the first mile and your body fires up and, you know, everything kind of, the kinks get worked out, and it totally uplifts your mood. I go to these races and I see people of every age, shape, size, every walk of life out running, and that's why I mean that running is so inclusive and democratic, because it's for everyone. It's not a big, I mean, racing can be kind of a financial commitment because marathon fees are expensive, but just getting out and running is not expensive. But for me, having the discipline to finish marathons and knowing that I could do that has helped me kind of finish some other things in my life and put some other things together. I had a dissertation that I'd been writing for years, and I wasn't sure I was ever going to finish, and I remember when I was finishing it, I was like, wow, I can do this, partly because I finished a marathon. And if I can run a marathon, then I can do anything.
Elizabeth Demers, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Melissa, thanks so much for having me on. I was just thrilled to do it.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Thanks so much for bringing that to us, Melissa. Well, that is our show for today. You've been listening to Current Sports with me, Al Martin, on WKRE East Lansing. As always, take care, have a fantastic day, and as always, be easy, people.